Well, last time we were looking at the question of our gathering together to Christ in verse 1 of chapter 2 and the question of whether the day of the Lord has already come. And in our study of verse 3, we basically focused on the first part of the verse, that it won't come and we shouldn't be deceived by any method or manner unless the whatever they call the apostasy comes first. And we spent all of our time, for the most part, dealing with whether or not apostasy is a legitimate term in this text, because it's highly prejudicial in English. We tend to think of apostasy being a turning away from God. But it was my argument, since Liddell Scott uses disappearance as his number two definition for the word in the secular setting in history, that Paul's issues in verses 1 and 2 are two: our gathering together to him and the coming of the day of the Lord. So if we're not supposed to be deceived, because that's not going to happen until the departure comes first, it makes all sense in the world to me that he's talking about 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, that the day of the Lord is not going to come until that event occurs, and then also the revelation of the man of lawlessness, who is in this verse also called the son of destruction. There is a little textual issue with the man of lawlessness, because the text behind the TR says the man of sin, and the text behind our translation is the man of lawlessness, antinomian, anomia, no law. And the textual critics give it a C rating, which means they couldn't make up their mind which one it was. But I'm going to go with the man of lawlessness, partly because they did settle on that, but also because in verse 6 he says, you know what restrains him now, so that in his time he may be revealed, for the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. And that's the word that's translated lawlessness. I mean, that's the legitimate word, and there's no textual issues there. And since the revelation of the man is tied together in verses 6 and 7 with the idea of lawlessness, I think the context argues that Paul probably had the man of lawlessness in mind. So if my assumptions are rooted in reality, in the sense that the day of the Lord isn't going to begin, the dark period of the day is not going to begin until the disappearance has occurred and the man of lawlessness has been unveiled, revealed. The question, of course, is the issue of his revelation. What will cause people to know that that's who it is? Well, the only real problem that I can see with identifying that event is Daniel is unhesitating in Daniel 9 in identifying the very beginning of the 70th week of Daniel, that last week of Israel's history before the Messiah actually sets up his kingdom. He is unhesitating in identifying the fact that the week will begin with a covenant, that the son of destruction, the one who makes desolate and is then made desolate in Daniel 9, he signs a covenant of peace with the many. And of course, you have to decide what that means. Probably it's more than just the Jews, but it probably will be with the Jews too. Because the focus of his covenant that he makes is it's a covenant of peace, and for the first 42 months of that 70th week, he gives an appearance of honoring it, but in the middle of the week, he causes the sacrifice and oblation to cease. This is Daniel's prophecy. And since the focus is on Daniel's people in the 70 weeks of Daniel, the covenant has to be at least made with them. But in order for it to stick as a covenant piece, the man who's making that covenant has got to have some influence in other countries in the world too that might threaten the peace of Israel. So the many may be Israel plus some other nations. In any case, if that's a public thing, and I can't see why it wouldn't be, that's the revealing issue. That's when the man of sin is revealed. However, when it talks about the revelation of the man of sin in this text, it goes immediately to the middle of the 70th week, because he talks about in verse 4 that this son of destruction opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. And that's a direct reference back to this causing the sacrifice and oblation to cease, because he then desecrates the temple by setting himself up there as God. And if my understanding of the prophecies in Daniel and Revelation is legitimate, I believe that what's happening there is the two witnesses of Revelation 13, I believe that's, yeah, no, Revelation 11, the two witnesses there prophesy for 1260 days. But in Revelation 11:2, the city is related to 42 months. Well, 1260 days on a 30-day lunar kind of month is 42 months. So the 42 months and the 1260 days are used in verse 2 of Revelation 11 and then verse 3 of Revelation 11. So they're the same amount of time. Now, whether the same period of time, that's another issue, but I've heard a lot of people say that they believe that the two witnesses are going to actually be exercising their prophetic ministry during the last half of the 70th week, and I don't agree with that at all. It has to be in the first half for a couple of reasons. One is, it's very clear from the prophecy that after 1260 days plus 1260 days, Messiah comes. In the prophecy of the two witnesses, you have 1260 days, and then they're put to death by this man of lawlessness, and he receives a mortal wound, I think, in the conflict between the two. And he kills the two witnesses, which are probably Elijah and Enoch. And I know there are a lot of people that wonder about that too. But nonetheless, they die, and their bodies are left lying in the street, and the whole world sees their dead bodies for 3.5 days. And then all of a sudden, their bodies are caught up visibly into the air, and everybody watches them ascend. In light of that reality, I think that in the conflict between the man of lawlessness and the two witnesses, he receives a wound to the head that's fatal, and then he comes back to life. So, he uses the fact that he was dead and is alive to promote himself as God. That fits the motif. And that's how I think he is able to then go into the temple that he has now rid the two witnesses from being any opposition. He goes into the temple and sets himself up there because he can claim that he has a biblical mandate for being there. I was dead and now I'm alive. So, that all depends on how you understand Daniel and Revelation. We're not studying Daniel and Revelation, but it does fit here because of Paul says in verse 5, "Do you not remember that while I was with you, I was telling you these things?" Now, we don't know exactly what he was telling them, but we do know that it had to do with this man of lawlessness. So, this evening, we're going to be talking about this man, because the description of him in verse 4 and the issues of verse 4, and then Paul's comment, "Don't you remember that while I was with you, I was telling you these things," introduces several things that we need to be aware of in terms of our grasp of how this is going to work out. In the first place, as I said, he says that the man of lawlessness is going to be revealed, but then he immediately goes to some events that are going to happen in the middle of the 70th week, and this may be part of the argument, I don't know, but it may be part of the argument for those who believe in a mid-tribulational event, because the only identification of the day of the Lord dark, the dark period of the day of the Lord, with the 70th week of Daniel is implication, not direct association. In other words, the day of the Lord is a period of darkness followed by light. It's a period of bad stuff, judgment, heavy duty, bad stuff happening, followed by some enormous blessing. That's the concept of the day of the Lord. Whether the day of the Lord starts in conjunction with the 70th week of Daniel is the question. And in this text, since Paul goes immediately to the midpoint of that 70th week, there are those, I think, that would probably argue, well, that's the beginning of the day of the Lord then, when he takes sets himself up as God in the temple. That's when all, if you can say it this way, all hell breaks loose and all the bad stuff's going to happen. The problem that I see with that is, by way of implication, the description of the ministry of the two witnesses in Revelation 11 says that they forbid it to rain for the entire period of their 1260 days, 3.5 years, 42 months. A drought of that magnitude would be considered, if it's worldwide, would be considered a heavy-duty judgment. Not only that, but anybody that opposes them, they can, the imagery is they can blow fire out of their mouth and destroy anybody that opposes them, which is a fairly significant image. So there's going to be some heavy-duty judgment of individuals by that means, if they oppose the witness of the two witnesses. And then it says that they will smite the earth with plagues as often as they will, or something along that line. So there's a lot of judgment going on in the first 1260 days of the 70th week. And since the day of the Lord is begun by a period of darkness, which emphasizes judgment, I believe that there's sufficient implication there that the 70th week is also the beginning of the day of the Lord, the dark period. But I will admit that Paul skips over the first 3.5 years because he's dealing with the epitome of the rebellion. And the epitome of the rebellion is his taking the temple over and seating himself in the temple as God. That's the ultimate rebellion of man. So, having said that, let's look at the way that the description of the man is made. The first issue is connected to the textual issue that I mentioned, the man of sin or the man of lawlessness. The word in verse 7, translated lawlessness in the New American Standard, is, I think, in the King James, the word iniquity. But it's anomia in either case. And so you've heard of the mystery of iniquity. You might not have heard of the mystery of lawlessness, but that's a translation issue. But I really believe that the man is called the man of lawlessness for a reason. That's the thing that characterizes him. And so it becomes a way of saying this is the worst, the most fully developed human rebellion against God that can be. This is Satan's human emissary on the earth in the final days of the rebellion that God is going to address in the person of the second coming of his own son, who he is going to slay this man with the breath of his mouth, according to verse 8. And that means that God has for the last 6,000 years allowed the mystery of lawlessness to gradually build and build and build and build and build, and build until finally there is a man called the man of the lawlessness. And the question is why he calls him that. The word lawlessness does just mean without law. But the whole idea of without law means that you don't allow any rule or regulation or law to determine what's right and wrong in any given case. If there is no law, then there isn't any way to decide what's right, what's wrong, whatever. And the whole idea of the man of the lawlessness is the idea of the man attempting to establish an absolute tyranny over the whole world under his self-deification. He's the God now. And given that, it's an absolute tyranny, which means that he's actually gone back to the old Babylonian model. In the Babylonian model of rule, the king was an absolute tyrant. They didn't call him a tyrant. But the fact is, he could make a law today and change it tomorrow. And he could make another law and change it. Nobody was ever really sure what was going to happen because the king was absolutely lawless. If he made a law, it applied to everybody but not himself. so he could turn around and change it if he wanted to. And that kind of thing apparently created enough kickback in the thinking of human beings that when the Medes and the Persians began developing their governmental structure and developing their dominion, and they took on Babylon as an adversary and defeated them, they had set up their rule of government as under the law of the Medes and the Persians. And the law of the Medes and the Persians was this: the king can make any law he wants to, but once he's made it, he's obligated to keep it himself. And that was how they tricked him into getting Daniel thrown in the lion's den, because they made him sign, or they tricked him into signing this goofy announcement about anybody that asked the king for anything for the next 30 days would be thrown in the lion's den, because they knew that Daniel was going to pray and ask his God for some stuff. I mean, that's the dumbest thing. I don't know what that king had in mind. Because technically, if a kid asked, if a baby asked his mom for a bottle of milk, he'd have to be fed to the lion. I mean, this makes absolutely no sense. But he signed it. And then he spent a sleepless night wondering whether his own foolish arrogance and pride had sacrificed a man of God that he thought very highly of. The next morning he was out there at the mouth of that pit saying, "Oh, Daniel, was your God able to deliver you?" And of course Daniel said, "Yeah, get me out of here." But the point being that the whole issue there was a method of government. And under Nebuchadnezzar's absolute hyper-egotism, the arrogance of Nebuchadnezzar was enormous. That's the whole point of the first three or four chapters of Daniel. That was a man who considered himself above any kind of rule or law. He could pass one, everybody else is subject to it, but not him. And that means that this man, the man of the lawlessness, and the lawlessness started in Babylon, in Babel, in Nimrod's Babel. The whole thing there is the idea that a single human being can become an absolute tyrant who is completely exempt from following his own laws. It's a total rejection of any kind of absolute standards that apply to everybody. And the idea of the rejection of absolute standards is the rejection of God himself. Because absolute standards come from the immutable character of God. And the whole idea of an immutable character means he has a certain character that will not, cannot change. And that means all of the issues of life and death and judgment and righteousness and blessing and darkness and light and all of those, all of the issues of all of Revelation, the truth that we know about God, is rooted in the immutable character. That's why Hebrews says, God who cannot lie. What do you mean? He can't say lying words? No, he can't say lying words because it's against his character and therefore he cannot do it. He's got this immutable character. For the man of the lawlessness to come on the scene and act like there is no such thing as an immutable character, then he establishes his mutable character in the place of God. It's the ultimate rejection. It's in a very real sense saying, I am having absolutely nothing to do with any God but myself. That's the wholesale rejection. That's what Satan has been working for ever since garden time in Genesis 3. He's been looking for humanity to come to the point where they will absolutely, totally reject the God who is. And of course his goal is to let himself become the replacement deity. That's why he said, I will lift up my throne above the throne of God in the prophecies of the Old Testament. So, that's why he's called the man of the lawlessness. He's going to be the final historical development of everything Satan's been working for since Genesis 3, working to get people to the point where they will acknowledge and succumb to the dogma that there is no real absolute. And that has a lot of implications. You ever wonder why our Congress passes laws and then exempts themselves from having to be in submission to them? It's right out of here. right now in our country, we have a seated president who has absolutely no commitment to keeping the Constitution of this country, even though he swore twice that he would uphold it. The point being is that he considers his fiat declarations as above the Constitution. He just say it, make it happen. He doesn't have to work through Congress to do this because he has the power to just declare it to be so. Well, that's the obvious outworking of this doctrine, that I am above the law. I don't have to keep the laws. I can make them for other people, but that, they can't impose them on me. Well, that is the essence, that's the bottom line essence of satanic, Luciferian rejection of God. That's why he's called the man of the lawlessness. It's the epitome of man, the man who has come to this point in history. And it's no accident, folks, that in our generation, this there are no absolutes concept has gained real traction. It's absolutely irrational. It's nonsensical. And even the people who promote it don't want it applied to them, because they'll tell you there are no absolutes. But if you threaten to kill them, all of a sudden it's absolutely wrong for you to do that. And so they're irrational, they're non-thinking, but the fact is, this is part of Satan's whole deceptive plan to bring humanity and this creation into final bondage. That's why he's called the man of the lawlessness. But he's also called, in verse 3, the son of destruction, which is an interesting title. The phrase, and the son of destruction, the son of the destruction, it's translated the son of perdition in the King James. There's another man that's called that in the New Testament, Judas Iscariot. He's called the son of perdition. Well, the son of the destruction. The question is, why is this man of lawlessness, the man who promotes the ultimate issue of lawlessness, a mutable character that can declare and decree laws for others but not be subject to them himself? Why is he called the son of the destruction? Well, part of that, I think, is related to Daniel's prophecy in Daniel 9, 26 and 27. Because Daniel says in Daniel 9 that desolations are determined until the desolation comes upon him who makes desolate, which is the prince that shall come that will set up this covenant, and things will run until he's finally destroyed by Jesus at the second coming. So the idea of being the son of destruction, I think, is exactly parallel with the Old Testament concept of being the one who's responsible for desolating and being desolated. In other words, he is the one who is causing desolations, but he is going to be made desolate. And in the text, we have every indication that that's exactly what's going on in this paragraph, because this son of the destruction is going to be destroyed in verse 8. He's going to be slain by the Lord with the breath of his mouth and bring an end to his appearance by his coming. So that's when he will be made desolate, when he is cast into the lake of fire, according to the way the Book of Revelation outlines it. So being called the son of destruction means a couple of things. Being a son of means that you're mimicking a former pattern. That's what being a son means. It means you're following the example set by a former pattern, so that you are your father the devil, you are sons of the devil, means you're copying his behavior and his attitudes and his way of thinking. In this case, this guy who is the man of the lawlessness, he's, the book of the Revelation says point blankly that he is possessed by the devil. And it's also true in this Second Thessalonians, where the whole idea is that this guy, according to verse 9, comes with all the activity of Satan and all the power and signs of signs and false wonders, including calling fire down from heaven and causing the mortal wound to be healed, or the man to be raised from the dead who was struck with it. Point is, you have to find a original pattern for the desolations, and then you have to look for the desolation itself upon the one who's causing them. That's what the son of destruction means. The implications are a couple. Number one, the son of destruction is going to be Satan's direct instrument for attempting to ultimately destroy all of the plan of God in this period of the 70th week or the dark period of the day of the Lord. That's what he's going to try to do. He's going to try to desolate the work of God. He's going to try to destroy it ultimately. But the outcome will be that he will be destroyed. And of course, that's what verse 8 says. So, as the son of destruction, the son of the destruction, the man of the lawlessness will not only create destructions, and the scriptures are very clear in all of Daniel's prophecies about all the wars that are going to be going on because this man is waging war against anybody and everybody who won't accept his absolute autocratic tyranny. And there are going to be rebellions all over the world against his rule. That's what's going to lead to the Battle of Armageddon. Armies from the south, armies from the east, armies from the north coming into where he's put himself in the Holy Land. They're going to come against him, and the Battle of Armageddon is going to develop out of his attempt to impose his tyranny on the whole world and their refusal to submit to it. So out of all of that, there's going to be an enormous amount of destruction because we have weapons of enormous amount of destruction. I think that Ezekiel's war in Ezekiel 38 and 39 gives a fairly clear description of nuclear war because the flesh just melts off the bones. The blood just is suddenly released completely and instantaneously so that it can actually flow 200 miles and parts of it will be up to the horse's bridles in depth. That's an enormous instantaneous amount of bloodletting. And I don't know all of the nuclear stuff, all the fission and all that. But I do know that the implications are the desolations, the destruction is going to be enormous over a wide stage of history in this period. But you reap it, you sow it. So the desolator is made desolate. And that's what verse 8 says, that the lawless one will be revealed, and the Lord will slay him with the breath of his mouth and bring an end to him by the appearance of his coming. So that's why he's called the son of destruction. He is the follower of the leader. Lucifer is the original destroyer, and he's his son, but both of them are going to end up being destroyed. And then verse 4 gives some specific, verse 3 were titles, verse 4 is actions. He opposes every so-called god or object of worship. He exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship. The word Satan actually means opposer. So, as the devil, he's a deceiver. As Satan, he's opposer. The deceiver as an opposer, he is opposed to God. As a deceiver, that's his method. He is going to oppose God by trying to deceive people and other angels into following his lead. So in this statement, he opposes. That means he is a son of the devil or of Satan as an opponent. And his self-exaltation just proves the point because that is the essence of the opposition. Satan opposes God because he wants his place. So what he does is he specifically opposes every god. So there will be no religion on the world allowed except the worship of himself. In the book of Revelation, we're told very clearly that if you don't accept his mark, you're going to be beheaded. And his mark is enforced by economic rule where you can't buy or sell if you don't accept his mark. All of that has to do with worshiping him. And the false prophet that comes on the scene says that you need to worship him and you need to show your loyalty by having his mark made on your right hand or on your forehead. That's your loyalty oath. It's kind of like being baptized, except it's a mark. But the whole idea there is that he is deliberately following Satan's opposition to the true God. And this has been at work for 6,000 years, building and building and building, until finally we're at a stage in history where philosophically and culturally humanity has bought into the idea of relativism. There's no absolutes. But that's only in the Western segment of the world. Islam doesn't believe that at all. And so something's going to have to happen to Islam. Ezekiel 38 and 39 tells us exactly what's going to happen to Islam, because all of the associates of the ruler of the north that invades Israel in Ezekiel's war, every one of those nations that's named is a Muslim country today. And they're going to be the allies of the invader, and they're all going to get their armies in on the mountains of Israel, and God's going to destroy them. So that'll eliminate all the Muslims, pretty much. It won't eliminate them individually all, but it'll decimate Islam as a religion. And he's going to be in great favor of that. It'll make his case. So he's going to oppose every religious persuasion, every persuasion of worship that worships an object, he is going to oppose, exalt himself over it. And the ultimate manifestation of that is that he is going to take his seat in the temple of the God, the true God. And this means that the temple in Israel has to be rebuilt. And we already know that from Revelation, because in the book of Daniel, he causes the sacrifice and oblation to stop in the midst of the week. Well, you can't stop it until it started, and it can't start without the temple. So the temple's got to be built. The practice of the sacrifice and oblation has to be ongoing, because they gave sacrifices every morning, every evening on the altar in front of the temple. So he's going to go into this building that's going to be built in Israel as a temple to Yahweh, the true God. And instead of honoring the true God, he is going to go in there and seat himself, probably on some form of a golden throne, though that's just a guess. He's going to take his seat in the temple, and he is going to declare, "I am your God." And that sounds about as weird to us as it did for Jesus to say that. I mean, when he made those kind of claims in the first century, the Jews put him to death for blasphemy. And that was their charge. It's a weird statement, but it's not weird when it's backed by the power of resurrection. And that's Paul's argument in Romans 1. Jesus was declared to be the Son of God by the resurrection from the dead. Paul's argument in 1 Corinthians 15 is that Christianity is legit because the resurrection validates it. Well, if that's the case, and this man is, in a very real sense, resurrected after being mortally wounded, he will have the claim. He'll be able to say, "I am your God. This is the proof. I'm here, living proof of the power of my own resurrection." So, that's what he's going to do. And the very idea that he specifically attacks the God of Israel as the ultimate thing is his tacit admission that this is the only God you have to worry about. Every other God and object of worship in the world is nothing. And he can treat them as nothing. But the God of Israel, the Father of Jesus Christ, has established in history an argument that Jesus is the Messiah, and by resurrection from the dead. So his argument will probably, part of this great deception that God's going to send to them in verse 11 of this chapter, is probably going to be something to the effect that I am the modern day Jesus. I am God's Son. I am the true God, proven by my own resurrection. It's an amazing deception. And it tells us what's been going on in the world for the last 6,000 years. Satan has been stridently at work trying to eliminate the people of God, Israel as the chosen nation of God, the church as God's instruments now in the world. He's been working to nullify and destroy it for all of these thousands of years, because he's always had in place, from the time of his own rebellion in heaven through Genesis 3 in the garden till now, he's always had the same plan. I am going to take God's job away from him. I'm going to be God. So this is as bad as it gets. That's what Paul is saying. The day of the Lord will not come until this man steps onto the stage in history. And when this man steps onto the stage in history, history has come to its most rottenness of all of the rottenness of humanity. It has come to the very essence of the rottenness of Satan's rebellion. And that's going to start God's reaction. That's the day of the Lord darkness, where he starts saying, judgment. He's going to start doing judgmental things to judge the people on the earth for their willingness to hear all this stuff. Okay. Questions or comments?